Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm John Hodge, joined by JC Abbott. JC, how you doing on this Monday?
I'm doing well. I mean, that was an interesting slate of action that we had this last week. Some exciting moments and some less than exciting games, shall we say.
It was more of a finger painting than a Picasso week in the Canadian Football League. But there's always lots to talk about. And maybe the best performance of the week, JC, was you going 4-0 against the spread. I don't think that's ever happened before.
I know. It's like a miracle. That's probably a testament to some of the results in the CFL that they were able to prove me right this week. But I'm going to take the victory. I'm taking it.
As you should. You, I think, were the biggest winner, really, of week three in the Canadian Football League. And let's get into talking about it. We'll also, of course, do some previewing of week four. Today, we're discussing BC Lions offensive lineman Corey Woodruff accusing Willie Jefferson of dirty play.
Which winless CFL team will be the first to get a victory?
Adam Big Hill signing with the Calgary Stampeders.
The Edmonton Elks releasing a starting member of their secondary.
A tweak coming to the next 5 weeks of CFL scheduling.
And the Saskatchewan Roughriders posting a handsome profit in 2024. But first,
Toronto Argonauts head coach Ryan Dinwiddie went off after his team's 39-32 loss to the Saskatchewan Roughriders. During his press conference, he ripped his team for taking too many penalties, his coverage unit for missing a player on Mario Alford's last-minute kickoff return, the officials for missing a block in the back, his offensive line for not blocking well enough, one of his linemen in particular for only weighing 280 pounds, and committed to cutting someone to send a message about selfish penalties. JC, was any part of Dinwiddie's rant unfair?
I don't think any part of the rant was unfair, Hodge. Like, all the things that Dinwiddie laid out happened. They were true, right? That was a egregious performance in a lot of ways by the Toronto Argonauts, despite that miraculous comeback at the end of the game, right? The defense allowed too many big plays. You can't lose a game like that on, it wasn't the final kickoff, but essentially the final kickoff of the game when Mario Alford brings that back when you don't have enough guys on the field. And then their penalty issues were not quite as bad as Saskatchewan's, but some of the worst that I've ever seen. So Dinwiddie was entitled to call out his team. I just have a few questions about the nature of how he did it. And the biggest thing that looms large for me right now, Hodge, is he goes out with that impassioned rant and he swears that heads are going to roll. Someone is going to lose their job tomorrow. They will not be here. Well, we are what, 3 days later, Hodge?
Yep.
Looking around. Everybody's still there.
Yeah, so is the release in the room with us? Like, where's the release?
And that's not to say the Argos might not make a move still, or there's been a move that hasn't been reported. That's all possible. But if you don't back up that type of talk, I think you risk losing the guys in the locker room, or at least losing whatever power and authority you had, because they see you're not serious about it. Or they see that you're not a person who can control your emotions in that moment. and not risk talking out of turn. So I don't think Dinwiddie's going to lose the Argos locker room, right? He's proven enough as a two-time Grey Cup winning head coach. But if he was going to talk like that, he needs to back it up. And he needs to take a little bit of personal accountability as well for having a football team that was that undisciplined and that did not have enough players on the field at the end of the game, right? That ultimately, no matter who is at fault for any of those individual actions, falls on the shoulders of the head coach. You have to take responsibility for that. I don't think Dinwiddie did at any point in that press conference, and that was a little bit disappointing. It was also disappointing that the only person more in the doghouse than his players because of that rant was me, because I had my girlfriend over that night, and the second I heard Dinwiddie go off, I had to tell her, sorry, honey, I got to write this article for the next hour. You got to take a back seat. So I got some personal beef with Dinwiddie as well, but there are some problems with that rant as much as it was fair.
Yeah, I will say this. I think some coaches, especially like first-year coaches, they come in and they want to be all piss and vinegar and, well, I'm going to not take the – and I think doing this type of press conference with a lack of clout is a big turnoff for me. I think it's a big turnoff for players. Dinwiddie is not that. This is a guy who's a four-year head coach in his fifth year now. He's won two Grey Cups. He's got three first-place East Division finishes. He's got a Coach of the Year award, and he's got over twice as many wins as he does losses in the regular season, 5-2 in the playoffs. So this is a guy who is proven, right, that he is a winning coach. He is an excellent head coach. And so I think when he stands up and says, yeah, we're not taking this anymore, we're not making these mistakes, I think, you know, at least his players should be receptive to that. They should know who they're playing for. This is not a first-timer who's shooting his mouth off. This is a championship-caliber head coach who has started the season 0-3. And is sick of it, especially considering how many of those wounds were self-inflicted in that Friday night loss to the Saskatchewan Roughriders. I don't think everything he said was totally accurate. Like, for instance, he ripped his coverage unit for only having 11 players. That is accurate, but he ripped the officials for a block in the back. I've watched that play like 30 times. I think the block in the back people are talking about is Caleb Saunders, rotational D lineman for the Riders, giving Brandon Calver, kind of a journeyman fullback linebacker type for the Argos, a bit of a shove in the back. I personally don't mind the non-call because I don't think Calver had a shot at catching Alford anyway. And also, I think we can't, as members of the media or fans, talk out of both sides of our mouths. Like, there were way too many penalties in this game. I fully agree with that. There was like 300 yards. So I don't think it's fair to be like, there's too many penalties in this game, but also the refs are letting way too much go. Like, you can't have it both ways, right? You have to say either at a certain point, the officials are doing a great job and the players have to clean it up, or the refs are getting too ticky-tacky. You can't do it both ways. The other thing that I didn't think was particularly accurate from Dinwiddie, or at least, well, let's talk about the accountability piece, JC, because this is a key thing. When you have 11 players on the field, right, that is a high school level mistake. I do give the Argos a little bit of the benefit of the doubt because they've had so many injuries, right? Eight guys on, eight guys off to the roster in week three. That's a big change. They also had in-game injuries, right? Derek Parrish left, did not return. But here's the problem. The special teams coordinator, Mickey Donovan, who I think generally does great work, one of the best special teams coordinators in the league, needs to catch that. But also Ryan Dinwiddie needs to catch that. This guy had a timeout. In the CFL, you are allowed to use one timeout in the last 3 minutes of the game. And there was nothing stopping Mickey Donovan, Ryan Dinwiddie, or somebody in the booth getting into Dinwiddie's headphones and saying, hey, we got 11 players on the field. Can we please call a timeout and get this fixed? So I would have liked to see a little bit more accountability there because Ryan Dinwiddie is, at the end of the day, responsible for getting the right number of players out on the field, as much as that is also, of course, a job for the players themselves, for the assistant coaches, all that. I think by and large, I was okay with what Ryan Dinwiddie said. By the way, Ryan Dinwiddie, is he the best quote in the CFL? Can we say that? Is he the best quote?
He's up there. He's right near the top. He's certainly among the most frank head coaches, right? And this isn't the first time that he's gone off in a similar manner to this. It's been a little bit since we've seen the truly fiery, passionate Ryan Dinwiddie, but he's usually good for one of these hot and heavy press conferences per year.
Yes, and I will say, speaking with him at Grey Cup last year, he is one of few people where there is no gap. Like you ask him a question, he will answer it right away. Generally speaking, especially head coaches, there's a pause. They think about what they really want to say, and they think about, well, what am I willing to say? And you get the latter answer. Ryan Dinwiddie is no filter in a good way. The other inaccurate thing he said, though, JC, of course, as you laid out, he said he was going to cut somebody. He hasn't cut anybody. Granted, again, it is still the start of the week. The Argonauts don't play for another 6 days as of this recording. They don't play till Sunday night. So theoretically, they could make a move Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever. But I was expecting a press release the next day, right? If you're the head coach, and Ryan Dinwiddie, by the way, not only the head coach of this team, he doesn't have the title, but he holds some of the power that in other organizations would go to the GM. Like, he carries a lot of weight in that building. If he wants to cut a guy Friday night after the game, he could do that. And I thought he was going to do that, and he didn't do that. And generally, I think it's bad practice to promise things that you can't or don't deliver on. That being said, again, given the success he's had, I think Dinwiddie deserves some of the benefit of that doubt. Again, if he was a first-year coach doing this, I'd probably rip him for calling out a player like that. Not by name, but calling out a player and saying, I'm going to cut this guy, and then not doing it. Dinwiddie, given his success, given the respect I have for what he's been able to do, and I think everybody should have for what he's been able to do in just 4 years in Toronto, not including this one, of course, I don't really have a problem with what he said. I appreciated the honest answers, the candor, and again, I don't think necessarily the block in the back is accurate, whatever, but I liked it. I liked the rant. I really did.
I appreciate what you said there about the context of who is doing the rant, because I do think that's important, right? Dinwiddie carries a lot more weight than some pipsqueak coming in who's only 3 games into his coaching career and is losing his cool. But I do think there is something to be said about sort of a lack of discipline verbally when you're out here taking shots at your own players, right? Like calling out a guard specifically for not being in the weight room in the off season. That's one of those quotes when you're hearing it live, Hodge. I don't know how you reacted, but I went, "Woo! Oh my." That, verbally, I said that, which was entertaining for the other people in the room. But like, that's sort of a lack of discipline as a head coach to go out there and take that type of shot. And you're talking about a team that lacked discipline. I look at the other side to the winning head coach and Corey Mace after the game. Of course, I listened to his comments to see what he would have to say, because his team was actually penalized more than the Toronto Argonauts were. I think it was like 129 to 173 in the penalty margin or something akin to that. And he was very balanced in his analysis and, you know, said he was disappointed in the penalties, but really didn't go off on it too much in the media. Now, I don't know what Mace said to his team behind closed doors, and we will see going forward, you know, what these two coaches do in practice and in meetings to ensure that this doesn't happen again and how those teams rebound. But it was interesting to see these two head coaches who previously worked together, right? Corey Mace was the defensive coordinator under Ryan Dinwiddie with the Toronto Argonauts, take very different approaches to essentially the same issue in terms of a lack of discipline in that game, which in fairness, there are a couple of soft calls, but overall, I thought it was a pretty well officiated game. It was just very sloppily played by both of these two teams taking selfish and unnecessary penalties.
Yes and no. I think that the terrible second and third quarters of this game have kind of changed the narrative. I thought the first quarter of this game was awesome. Like Kevin Mattel makes an unbelievable catch. I think it was the second quarter, but Mitch Pickton makes an unbelievable catch on the sideline. Dante Myers, right, rips off a slant, turns it into a, you know, 75, whatever yard touchdown it was. Like early on, there were some big plays. I mean, heck, AJ Ouellette, we got to give AJ Ouellette credit. Two really good back-to-back games. We've been critical of him. Two great games.
Forget AJ Ouellette. Like the was polls on that. Oh, that's the best offensive line single play that I may have ever seen. Like when they're coming around that corner, I mean, beautiful kick out from Jacob Brammer. Morgan Runge, the fullback, climbs to the second level like nobody's business, gets the next block. And then you've got Trevon Tate out in front of A.J. Ouellette, and it's exactly how you want. He's got A.J. Ouellette's hand on his back, and he's just picking where he wants him to block and then blows the guy up. Clean sailing. Kudos to the Saskatchewan Roughriders offensive line that has gone through a lot of injuries so far this season and has remained largely effective. That was an impressive, impressive execution on that particular play.
It is spelled Trevon Tate. I believe it's pronounced Travion Tate, but I could be corrected on that. My apologies
to Travion Tate.
All good. Ben Grant.
I'm sure he's listening right now.
Ben Grant, who does obviously brilliant work out of Toronto, has all the pronunciations down because he does radio for them. I believe it's Travion. Tate used to play there in Toronto. But yes, and by the way, I think the Riders, like my concern week one was the interior of this offensive line is not good enough, right? This is essentially what they had last year. Yeah, they tried to improve it in the offseason. Sean McEwen coming in, Philippe Gagnon coming in. But Jacob Brammer, Travion Tate at guard with Logan Ferland in the middle, that is a very good interior. And Daniel Johnson, the second-year Canadian out of Purdue, has been very good at left tackle.
What a feel-good story.
Through two games. A guy who just had a miserable time staying healthy at the collegiate level, fell in the draft as a result of that. Through two games, passing the test with flying colors. So I am bullish on the Riders. Trevor Harris, I thought, had his worst game in a year. That was not a good performance from Trevor Harris, but I think it's a good sign in the CFL. You can go on the road and you can beat a championship team. No, the Argos don't look as good, of course, as they did at the end of last year, but it's still a championship team and you can beat them when your quarterback has his B game, or dare I say even C game. So good for the Riders, good for the interior of that O-line, good for the running backs. I'm very sad Kadeem Carey didn't play, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in the show later on. But overall, I don't have a problem with what Ryan Dinwiddie said. The other thing I found confusing is he said we had more penalty yards than offensive yards. If you combine the teams, that's true. But Toronto had 293 offensive yards and 129 penalty yards. That confused me a little bit. But regardless, again, if anybody in the CFL has earned the right to do this postgame, it is Ryan Dinwiddie. I think Mike O'Shea also deserves to do it. A guy who's in the Hall of Fame as a player, has won a couple of Grey Cups. But Mike O'Shea, I think, would never do this. No, he would rather eat a bowl of sawdust and glue than criticize one of his players publicly. He will admit sometimes that he is upset with things that happened on the field, but he would never, ever, ever do this. It's just two different coaching styles, right? I mean, you laid it out with Corey Mace. You laid it out with Ryan Dinwiddie. I don't have a problem with it. It was entertaining. It was good for members of the media. And I thought that it was honest, which is refreshing, right? Whenever you get honesty in this business, that's a good thing.
With the Red Blacks getting their first victory in week three, there are now just three winless teams left in the CFL: Edmonton, Hamilton, and Toronto. Which of these three teams will be the first team to snap their slow start?
Oh boy, JC. I was looking at the week four schedule here, and it is not kind to two winless teams. The Edmonton Elks have to go to Winnipeg this week. Oh, wow. Edmonton, great fourth quarter, really good fourth quarter. The problem is that they'd already lost by the time the fourth quarter started against Montreal in week three. I think they're in really tough against the Bombers at Princess Auto Stadium. I think it's going to be, if not a sellout, very close to. And I think that the Bombers are not unbeatable at home, but pretty close, especially considering how they looked in week, or I shouldn't say week one, how they looked in their home opener in week two. I mean, you were at the game in Vancouver, JC. Offensively, I thought they were very unimpressive, actually. I think part of that, deservedly so, the credit goes to Mike Benavides, who I thought made some really great adjustments to BC's defense from game one to game two against Winnipeg in that home and home. But Winnipeg was not impressive at all offensively last week, and yet they beat BC quite handily. And Edmonton's defense through two games has struggled terribly. I think that'll be a nice antidote to Winnipeg's offensive struggles in week three. And I think the Bombers defense is going to give Trey Ford fits. I do not think the Elks get their first win this week. Obviously, we'll do our picks on Wednesday. I'll plug that. The next day, the Hamilton Tiger Cats, coming off their bye, host the Montreal Alouettes, who thus far this year have kicked the crap out of everybody they've played. No, Montreal hasn't had the toughest schedule thus far, but all you can do is beat the team that's in front of you. I do not think the Tabbies get their first win of the season. To be the team most likely to get it done is the Toronto Argonauts, who are visiting the Ottawa Redblacks on Sunday. If Drew Brown is back for this game, and it seems like there's a good chance he is, though nothing is officially confirmed, I think the Redblacks have a very good chance of winning this game. But if Chad Kelly makes his return, I think that changes it. Credit, by the way, Nick Arbuckle, his best start of the season by far, but I don't think anybody believes that Nick Arbuckle is an elite quarterback in this league or that he's on the level of Chad Kelly. So I think the Argos have the best chance of doing it. I also think it's possible, JC, none of them do it, in which case the first win will guaranteed be Friday, July 4th. Why do I say that? Well, it's because the Tiger Cats and the Argonauts play each other. If both teams are winless at that point, something will give. Though I just realized, I guess there could technically be a tie. Heaven forbid.
Don't please speak do not that tie. Into existence.
Please do Come not on, tie. Hodge. Let's get a win. I don't care which team it is. One of them get the win. If none of them get it in week four, hopefully we don't see a tie in week five.
Yeah, we're not going to talk ties here on the podcast because that's going to open up a whole other can of worms. But that's the game that I'm looking at, Hodge, that July 4th matchup between the two Ontario rivals, because that's where I think that the winless streak is going to snap for somebody. And I would think it's going to be the Toronto Argonauts. I expect that Chad Kelly will be back in the lineup this week. That seemed to be what Ryan Dinwiddie indicated a week ago, that he was just one more week away, needed to get a little bit more mobile. If everything has held since then, that would indicate that he's going to start this week. But I'm not going to bet on a guy coming off that type of devastating injury after that type of absence to be in fine form in his first performance, right? There's going to be a little bit of an adjustment back to game speed. I think Chad Kelly will probably be less mobile than he's used to. That's going to affect how he plays. That's going to be a little bit tougher against a better team in the Ottawa Redblacks that might also be getting better because of Drew Brown if he's healthy. Against the Hamilton Tiger Cats and some of the problems they've had on defense, some of the lack of pass rush that they've shown, I think there's going to be enough there for that suspect Toronto O-line to hold down the fort. And then Chad Kelly potentially can go to work in that game. Now, I am actually fairly low on Toronto compared to these other teams. I think there's a lot more potential to Hamilton. I think there's a lot more to unlock from Edmonton down the line. But I think ultimately, Chad Kelly and his addition is the biggest change that any in this group can experience. And when you're looking to break a snap, something has to change. If you're getting an injection that large at a certain point, it's going to impact your performance, and I think it will for the Argonauts. I think Hamilton, the issues have been the same as they were, you know, in previous years. The offense seems to work. Bo and Kenny Lawler are getting along great. You've got to sort out that defense. And then Edmonton, right, if we could bottle fourth quarter Trey Ford and just get that to play every single game, we'd be fantastic. But unfortunately, we get first through third quarter Trey Ford more often than not, and he has not looked super comfortable with what Jordan Maksimek has asked him to do. He's not making his initial reads. He's holding onto the football. He's putting himself in trouble. He's trying to make plays when he's not supposed to make plays and missing wide open reads. That's a problem, right? And he's got to address that. He looked fantastic in that fourth quarter. I'm not trying to take anything away from him, but you wonder how much of that was actually within the same system that he was supposed to play in within the other three quarters, and how much of that was them desperately taking the reins off of him. And if that's true, then why not take the reins off of him all over? It just seems like an awkward fit right now with, you know, one of the most regimented offensive coordinators in the league and one of the least regimented quarterbacks we've ever seen in this league in Trey Forg. And I just hope they find a way to give him the freedom and scheme specifically for him, like, you know, the Baltimore Ravens have done with Lamar Jackson, instead of trying to shove him into a box that I don't think he's comfortable with right now, Hodge.
Yeah, and we talked about this in previous episodes, right? The problem with Trey Forg is not a lack of ceiling. He will make a play or two a game that makes your jaw drop. Like, he will make 11 out of 10 plays. The problem is the low floor, right? The floor of his game has to be higher because, yes, he will miss open throws. He will pass on open reads trying to buy time or turn something that is only supposed to be that 6 yard, you know, drag on first down or that 4 yard out on first down into something more, which is just, you know, it's exciting. It's interesting, but not every play should be a touchdown. Just like when you're up to bat, you shouldn't be trying to actively hit a home run on every single pitch, right? It's just not realistic based on what you're given. You got to pick and choose your moments. So I will say this. I think the pressure is on Edmonton more than anybody else. And the reason why is totally out of their control. It's the standings, right? I think it's pretty abundantly obvious that barring a shocking turn of events, the Montreal Alouettes are going to be hosting the East Final again this year. They currently have a 4-point lead on Montreal and a 6-point lead on Hamilton and Toronto for first place in that division. Obviously, there's lots of head-to-head games to be played still, and they could be caught, but like through three games, they've looked lights out. Davis Alexander, by the way, finally had a bit of a breakout game after two, not poor performances, but two kind of middling performances to start the year. Looked like $1 million against Edmonton's defense, and unfortunately, you know, left the game, got hurt, but seemed to indicate it was for precautionary reasons. That should mean that he's ready to go for week five. We'll obviously keep tabs on that, but McLeod Bethel-Thompson is hardly, you know, some, you know, meager second option. McLeod Bethel-Thompson has thrown a ton of touchdown passes in this league, so I think they would be very effective with him under center as well. So Edmonton, meanwhile, right, they're in trouble right now, right? They're 6 points behind Saskatchewan. They're 4 points behind Winnipeg and Calgary. And you've got to finish top three, right? I know you can make the playoffs as the 4 seed with a crossover, and the crossover might be in effect this year. But I don't think anybody picked Edmonton to finish top two in the West Division. I had Saskatchewan and Winnipeg top two in the West Division. I think most pundits did. But that third spot, I mean, Calgary is better to start this year than I think a lot of people expected, though their performance at home in terrible conditions is not at all impressive. By the way, I want to say this because I think it needs to be said. If you were at the game in Calgary at McMahon Stadium on Saturday, you are a real one, okay? You are a real one. I respect you. You are a real one. That is a CFL diehard fan. I think some of the excuses for poor attendance in this league are a joke, where people will be like, well, it was Thursday. Or it's like, well, there was a concert in town. Like, it's like, give me a break. Like some of these excuses are ridiculous. That game with that weather on that Saturday, like the old phrase is come hell or high water. Well, the latter happened. There was very, very high water. It was an absolute monsoon. It was terrible weather conditions. I believe Ryan Ballantyne, who covered the game in person, said it was the coldest June 21st on record in Calgary history. So if you attended that game, especially from pole to pole, if you started it and finished it, you have my eternal respect. Shout out to the Stamps fans who showed up and showed out. That is awesome. There weren't many of them, but there's a reason, and I think that's a valid game for people to have said, you know what? I think we could watch this one on TV. So if you were at the game, good for you. I respect you. And if you see me at a Grey Cup or a Combine or any other CFL event, come and let me know. I want to shake your hand.
I think the exact quote from Ryan was, you know, there was 15,584 or whatever the exact number was, tickets sold for this game, and I think 15,000 of them dressed as empty seats. Most people made the wise choice to stay home from that weather. Though I must admit, Hodge, I get a little bit of satisfaction when people from other areas of the country avoid rain like the plague, because now I get to feel how I imagine the rest of you feel when Vancouverites complain about snow and get all superior. It's like, that's nothing. I go out in 60-kilometer winds with torrential downpour every day in the winter time. It's nothing. How could they be so soft?
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I get what you're saying. And yeah, I personally hate rain and don't mind snow. I would certainly fit that as a Winnipeg guy. But this was not just rain. Like, this was torrential rain, crazy wind, and just frigid temperature for a June day. I think it was feeling like 2, right? Like, so the people who were there, you are real ones. Good for you. Hopefully we never get another game like that. At least certainly not this season.
I don't want to watch one like that again. So,
no, it was not fun to watch either. But again, I think this is one of few instances where the players had a pretty good excuse. Like, yeah, the ball was impossible to hold on to because it was absolutely soaked at all times. So I get it. Anyway, that was wild. But yeah, Edmonton's under more pressure than anybody else in the league. And that's only going to get ratcheted up, I think. I don't want to say when they lose in Winnipeg, because it's a CFL, anything can happen, but they're going to need a lot of things to go their way to beat the Bombers at Princess Auto Stadium. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's impossible, but I would be shocked if anybody picked the Elks to win in week 4. I know I will certainly not be picking them. And I wouldn't be surprised if this line was like Winnipeg -8, -9, dare I say -10. I think it's going to be the most lopsided spread we've seen so far this season. In a story you exclusively reported, JC, BC Lions offensive lineman Corey Woodruff claimed Blue Bombers edge rusher Willie Jefferson did something dirty during Saturday's game, which instigated their late game exchange that resulted in both players being ejected. What happened?
Well, the reality is, I don't really know, Hodge. I spoke to Corey Woodruff in the locker room post game, and he revealed this information saying that Willie Jefferson did something dirty to one of his teammates on the play prior to the incident and in the aftermath of that play, but he did not elaborate any further than that. I asked him what Jefferson did. He declined to say. I asked him if it was physical or if it was verbal. He indicated that it was both, but nothing more than that. So in terms of Jefferson's actions, I can't really provide much more information, but in the aftermath of whatever it was that happened, the two of them got into it, a fray ensued, and James Vaughters essentially got in between the two of them, and Corey Woodruff, while shoving James Vaughters' arms away, drove it into the back of umpire Kyle Mikulik's head, which sent him to the ground. He had to be attended to by the training staff, and resulted in Woodruff getting ejected. Now, I don't think there was any intent on this action by Woodruff. In fact, I don't even think he realized the referee was in his vicinity. He didn't make actual contact with the referee himself, but it was certainly a fair ejection because his action resulted in a referee getting harmed. And Woodruff admitted he's got to be better in that situation. There's no excuse for it. The ejection was merited. I'm sure he'll get fined. I don't think there'll be anything more than that to come from this situation. As for Jefferson, he's got a bit of that reputation as an instigator. It served him really well throughout his CFL career. I can't speak to his actions because obviously I don't have that information. But I will say, I think the CFL should look into his conduct a little bit, in particular how he left the field, because he was also ejected on that play because he was given a misconduct penalty, which was his second of the quarter. 2 in a game is an automatic disqualification. And he seemed almost gleeful in the way that he exited the stadium, waving to the other team, waving to the fans. you know, that sort of action after a serious incident, I don't think is particularly becoming of a guy who is a respected veteran in this league. And someone should probably give him a little bit of a talking to for that, but we'll see what comes of it from the CFL.
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard that Willie is dirty. That word I don't think has ever been thrown out publicly. I've never heard it privately. Certainly he's spirited, right? I do think he likes to stir things up. He's always dancing, having fun, and I think that that's part of what makes Willie so entertaining to watch is the fact that he is so high energy and seemingly never, ever, ever runs out of steam, whether it's during the play or whether it's after the play, on the bench or what have you. That being said, he did take an unnecessary roughness penalty in week two. And then he took, as you said, JC, two misconduct penalties. Yes, and got fined for it. And then two misconduct penalties resulting in an ejection. That's a rule that changed a couple of years ago. If you take two, you're out. So that is not very Blue Bombers, right? Traditionally under Mike O'Shea, certainly the last 5-6 years, Winnipeg has been the least penalized team in the CFL or one of the least penalized teams in the CFL. I know Mike O'Shea was upset with his team in week two for taking, I believe it was 90 penalties for 80 yards. Overall, their penalties were down in week three, but I know that when he spoke to Derek Taylor on the CJOB 680 postgame show, that he was not happy with what happened with Willie Jefferson. Again, Mike O'Shea is not one to rip a player publicly, but he did make a negative comment about the nature of some of the penalties that his team took. So he seems frustrated by it. I would expect this to get nipped in the bud here and now. I think Willie Jefferson is a good enough player. He doesn't have to do dirty things. Again, I'm not saying don't instigate or never say anything. There's all kinds of jawing that happens on the field in every single game from every, you know, unit, offense, defense, special teams, whatever. That's part of pro sports, not even pro football. That's part of pro sports, right? Is trying to rattle opponents, get underneath people's skin. But Willie Jefferson, again, I don't know if he did anything dirty or not, JC, neither do you. We're just going off of something that Corey Woodruff claimed to have witnessed. But regardless, this has to get dialed in and it can't continue because Willie Jefferson, he's a Hall of Fame talent, right? If he retired today, he'd certainly be in the Hall of Fame. He might be a first ballot guy, right? He unofficially leads the CFL's history in pass knockdowns. He's been an all CFL guy, I think, six times. He'll never reach the top of the sack list, but he's got enough sacks to be that type of a potential first ballot guy. So I think absolutely this needs to get cleaned up. And I guess maybe a bright side for both teams is these two teams are done playing each other now, right? It's a weird scheduling quirk that division rivals don't play after June 21st, which is really odd. But if there was any beef lasting between these two teams, it won't matter until a potential playoff matchup. So at least that side of it is something that the coaches don't have to worry about.
I do think an element of this, Hodge, was sort of a bubbling up of 2 weeks worth of, frankly, embarrassment for the BC Lions, right? Willie Jefferson in week two looked lights out. I don't think he was quite as good in week three, but that didn't really matter because the BC offensive line made some egregious errors in this game. And, you know, Jeremiah Mazzoli is going to get a lot of flack from fans and from the media for how he played in that game. And rightfully so. He did not look good in his relief effort over Nathan Rourke. But the reality was on those three biggest mistakes, the two interceptions and the lateral that was fumbled by James Butler and picked up for a touchdown, there was major pressure in his face. In fact, on that lateral play, three interior offensive linemen failed to block nose tackle Cameron Lawson. Just not at all. Not even a hand on him. And Corey Woodruff admitted to me in the same conversation after the game, that was his fault. He failed to communicate there. His eyes weren't in the right place, and he let him go untouched. It was not the only time that Cameron came through basically untouched. He also laid the hit on Mazzoli on the first interception, which also went to Parker. Mazzoli got hit by Vaughters on the second interception by Evan Holm when Andrew Pearson got beat at the same left guard spot that Woodruff was playing. This was after Dejon Allen went down and Woodruff had to kick out to right tackle. So there was problems along that offensive line for BC that directly impacted the result of the game with an older and less mobile quarterback than what they're typically used to blocking for behind them. And frankly, I think they were a little bit chuffed by that, right? They were embarrassed. They had red cheeks, and I think that got the better of Corey Woodruff once there was some, you know, I would say nothing egregious, but the regular sort of dirty jawing and after play antics that happen in a professional football game. Well, Corey Woodruff reacted because it had been bubbling up for 2 weeks. And unfortunately, he paid a price for that. I'm sure he's going to pay a financial price for that moving forward. And he should.
And I'll say this before we move on. I don't care what the situation is. If an official goes down, I'm glad that that is an automatic ejection now. Officials, I think, across sports are not treated with enough respect. I get frustrated when I go to, you know, youth sporting events. I was at one this past weekend, my niece and nephew playing flag football. That event was well run. There were no issues, but it's very common, right? Every Canadian has sat in an ice rink at some point and seen some middle-aged parent absolutely berate and harass some poor teenager who's just trying to earn their $20 officiating an 11-year-old's hockey game, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to pay more respect to officials. Are they perfect? No, but I think generally the CFL's officiating is good. And by the way, we let players make mistakes every single game, whether it's dropping passes, missing blocks, right? Missing tackles, dropping interceptions. Terrell Bonds, by the way, had a chance to ice that game. I think it was late first quarter, would have made it 24-3 and dropped a would-be interception from Jeremiah Masoli that hit him right in the hands. So if we're going to let players make mistakes every single game, I think we need to be more respectful of officials and pay them that same mind. Because again, I watch every CFL game all year, and I go to probably 25 of them live. And it's very rare that I leave a game going, wow, what a badly officiated game. It happens maybe twice a year. And generally, I don't think about the officiating post game. Why? Because it's good. When officiating is good, you never talk about it. When officiating is bad, that's when you talk about it. It's like long snappers, right? It's like offensive linemen, right? There are certain players where when they do their job, nobody talks about them. When they mess up, everybody talks about them. Officiating is the same way. So I'm glad that officials, especially when they are in actual danger, right, on a field, are getting this level of protection. They should be able to do their jobs without fear that they're going to get struck by a 320-pound human being who is, you know, quite literally employed because they are obscenely strong. Like, that just needs to happen.
The Calgary Stampeders have signed veteran linebacker Adam Big Hill, who is coming off a torn ACL from last year. Hodge, why did the move happen, and what do you expect to see from Big Hill in the red and white?
Well, I think it happened because the Stampeders are as banged up at linebacker almost as any team can be at a position. And this goes back to the offseason when Fraser Sopik, Grey Cup winning linebacker, who I think was their plan to start at weak side linebacker, suddenly retired. Then Markel Lee goes down in week two, who was starting at middle linebacker, was Three Down Nation's defensive player of the week in week one, by the way, and appears to potentially be out for the season. I think Mark Steven reported he's got a torn bicep. Like, that is nasty. Dickinson has been talking for a couple weeks about how their team is really thin at that position. And I think that was evident in week three because they got run all over by Ottawa's team. I mean, I think Dustin Crum threw for like .111 in that game, and the Red Blacks were still able to win because they put up close to 250 yards along the ground. So I think that that's the reason why Adam Big Hill's a fit there. I also think for a team looking to reset the culture, Adam Big Hill's a perfect fit, a guy who's a true professional, a consummate pro, a leader, a guy who will always answer questions post-game, easy questions, tough questions, win, loss, whatever, he will answer them all. And then he's obviously a Hall of Fame player, right? I don't think Adam Big Hill is playing at the same level now as he did in 2018 or before he left for the NFL back in like 2015. But the guy's a three-time most outstanding defensive player. I still think there's some gas in the tank. By the way, he's sixth all time in CFL defensive tackles. I went and looked at the list. He only needs 16 more to catch Baron Simpson for fifth and 40 to catch Chip Cox for fourth all time. I think those are both in play. And the other thing that's nice for the Stampeders is he is just on the PR right now. So a guy who's 36 years old, coming off a very serious knee injury that didn't happen that long ago, right? A lot of people need, you know, 11, 12 months still for an ACL. Adam Big Hill tore it at the Labor Day Classic. Like, he is still not that far along. It's been, what, 10 months, give or take, since that injury took place. So for a guy of his age, it's still pretty early. But with him on PR, I think you get a good opportunity to get him in the building. He can help teach and prepare some of your younger linebackers, and you can get a really good sense of exactly where he is in his recovery. And you can have an opportunity for him to learn the system, right? And so I think this is a win all the way around. If he shows up and he's banged up and he's not in game shape, I don't think that's the case, by the way, but if that's the case, you don't owe him anything, right? You can cut him next week if you want to. So it's a low risk, potentially high reward move for the Calgary Stampeders. And I love it for Biggie too, because again, Biggie, a consummate pro, Hall of Famer, and I love that he's getting a chance to maybe write his own final chapter, right? He made it very clear at last year's CFL awards ceremony where he won the prestigious, was it the Tom Pate that he won, JC?
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
You know, award that's literally given out to somebody who gives back to their community and is a leader in the Canadian Football League. He made it clear he wants to keep playing. So I'm thankful for him that he's getting this chance, because again, I don't think anybody's expecting the Biggie of old, but current day Biggie might still be a good enough player to make an impact on your defense.
This is going to be absolutely bizarre to see on the field, because Adam Big Hill in Stampeders red and white is just not how I imagine him. It happens to so many players late in their career that they have to switch uniforms, but this is a guy who, after leaving BC after a long stretch, remained very true to Winnipeg throughout that entire his entire tenure there, and you really don't think of him as anything other than a bomber. That's going to be shocking to see. But the fit here is real, right? I think it's a perfect one for a variety of elements. You laid out very eloquently the need that the Calgary Stampeders have at linebacker. I'd throw the injury to Gary Johnson Jr., who's also on the six-game injured list, into that equation as well. They clearly need to upgrade that position. I think Adam Big Hill does that in spades. The other element is this is a team that has been wanting to change their culture, right? And they brought in Vernon Adams Jr. on offense to really try and do that. I think that's been largely successful thus far. On defense, I think you can say that Falar and Armalade is a part of that culture-changing piece. But now you bring in Adam Big Hill, right? And there is perhaps no better defensive leader in the CFL than what Biggie brings to the table with his wealth of experience and his knowledge of how to win, right? From playing in that Winnipeg Blue Bombers defense and leading them to two Grey Cup victories and five straight Grey Cup appearances. He is a guy who can elevate everybody around him. Now, he was a free agent that had very little to do with talent, because I think Adam Big Hill is no longer a premier linebacker in this league, but he's better than a lot of guys who are starting, certainly better than a lot of guys who are on game day rosters across the CFL. It's just the reality is, A, he was coming off injury, which affects things, and B, when you have a 36-year-old who is now a slightly above average to average player, it doesn't make a lot of sense from a long-term roster construction standpoint to keep him around or to pay him to have that role when you can potentially develop a younger player and say, hey, with these reps, you might be average now, but you'll be a very good player in a year from now, right? Teams have to think long-term to a certain extent. Adam Big Hill can plug a gap. He's going to be very competent in there. I'm sure he's going to move up those all-time tackle charts. But ultimately, he's not going to get better in a year or two from now, because he may only have a year or two left. But when you're the Calgary Stampeders and you're as desperate as they are to fill that hole in the middle, there could be no better candidate.
And I don't think teams should, you know, throw away the future. But I also think of any sport, football is the least future oriented, right? Like, careers are short in professional football. You can turn around a roster pretty quickly. The number of guys coming out of college who have the potential to play professionally is far greater than the guys coming out of the college ranks to play professional basketball or some other sports, right? I mean, the NHL, you draft kids at 18 and you expect to invest in some cases, literally 3, 4, 5, 6 years of development before you're going to have them on your NHL team. If you ever get them. Pro football is not that way, right? You're pretty lucky as a pro football player. If you get, especially in the CFL, 2 years to sit and develop, two is kind of the magic number. For some Canadians, maybe you get a third one just because there's a smaller talent pool. But regardless, I think that the Stamps are smart for making this move, right? They are 2-1. They're off to a better start than I think a lot of people predicted. This is the weakness of their roster right now. You may as well bring in a vet who can make you better today. Let's worry about 2026 another day. Right now, let's just worry about trying to get back to the playoffs. The Stampeders certainly have that as a goal. Adam Bakehill might be able to help them do that. In week 4, we're getting our first 4-day slate of games, as one CFL contest will be played each day from Thursday through Sunday. This trend of Sunday games will continue through week 8. JC, how do you feel about Sunday games?
Well, I feel two very different ways about it. The football fan in me loves it because I get to watch my favorite thing in the world for an extra day. I love watching CFL football. That's why I do what I do. And to have 4 straight days of it is a blessing. Now, JC Abbott, the person who has a social life and, you know, people who love him and want to be able to see him on the weekends, doesn't love it. And it gets him in a little bit of trouble because on Sunday night, when I'm usually free, now I'm going to be watching even more football, which I'm sure just delights my loved ones. But, you know, they can handle it for a couple of weeks, Hodge, because I'm going to be in all my glory watching some beautiful Sunday CFL action.
I'm a huge fan of this. I think one game a day is best. I like that when you don't have a doubleheader, you only have 3 hours of football. I think it's a lot easier to stay engaged for that. Like, I often find if it's a doubleheader, especially if the second game is a bit of a dog, the second half can be hard to get through, right? It can be hard to keep focusing, keep paying attention. So I like when the games are spread out. I really do. And for the record, last season, the CFL had Sunday games from week 1 to week 12. And of those 12 weeks, the Sunday game drew a higher rating than the Saturday game. So there's also some evidence to suggest that while maybe the local fans don't like Sunday games as much, attendance might not be as high, the TV ratings are higher. The TV ratings are better. And also, I will say this, as long as a Sunday game isn't late, like if I think it'd be a mistake to start a game, you know, on Sunday at local 7:30 p.m. But if the game starts at local time, you know, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, I don't see why anybody should be upset with that. To me, that is one of the lame excuses, right? We talked about some of the excuses that teams or players or fans will use for low attendance or low crowds. I think, oh, it was on Sunday. It's like, well, but it started at 4 o'clock. Like, you got home by 8. Like, that's not, you know, you should be happy with that, but whatever. I think that's a lame one. Monsoon and frigid temperatures, I think, is valid. Regardless, I like the Sunday games. I'm looking forward to this week. And I like that every game kind of gets a chance to stand on its own, right? We get to celebrate 4 days of football, and then it's only 3 days of no football before you get to the next game. So I like the Sunday games a lot. It's now time for Hodge's Heritage Moment. On this day in 1988, the CFL All-Stars defeated the Edmonton football team at Commonwealth Stadium by a score of 15-4. It was the CFL's first All-Star game since 1983, and the format was a throwback to the early 1970s when it was traditional for the CFL's All-Star team to play against the reigning Grey Cup champions, of course, a year later. The game drew a crowd of 27,573, and was the last CFL All-Star game ever played. And I say that because I think it's pretty reasonable to suggest that this thing is not coming back. I don't think we're ever getting another All-Star game. JC, if the CFL had an All-Star game in 2025, would you be hyped for it?
No, I would not be hyped for it because I think we've seen basically through every All-Star game being played in professional sports right now that players don't care, right? They don't care about All-Star games or All-Star showcases. There was a time in the 70s and 80s when players would show up to these events, even into the 90s, and it mattered, right? They wanted to show out against the best. There would be hits. There would be big plays. That doesn't exist anymore. Now, do I think the CFL should maybe explore something like what the NFL does with their flag football in the Pro Bowl? I think that could be intriguing, especially with all the talk around flag football in the Olympics going forward. And by the way, Team Canada just played a nice round-robin tournament at the International Bowl down in the United States, beat Team USA, a really good first step Paul Lapalisse's team in terms of working towards qualification for those Olympics. So kudos to them. But that's something I think the CFL could examine. Will it be particularly intriguing to me? No, I'm probably not going to be fired up for it, but I'll watch.
I think All-Star games work okay at best in some sports. I think basketball, it works pretty well. Baseball, I think it works well. These are also sports that generally don't have a lot of contact and can be played at a more leisurely pace. There is no leisure in football, and there is only one pace in football, which is as fast as you freaking can, okay? So, no, I never, ever, ever in a million years want to see another All-Star football game. I don't care if it's CFL. I don't care if it's NFL. I don't care if it's the Barbados National Rugby Football Spectacular. I do not want to see All-Star games, anything but All-Star games. You're always going to get at least one injury, and no one's going to know that. Like, the playbook will be the most bare bones thing, and there's really no incentive to learn it anyway. Football is not a sport where you can just kind of pick up and play. Football is not that. So no, I don't want to see All-Star games ever, but I think it's cool. They used to do it. That's fair.
Who would be the CFL Sean Taylor? I don't know if you remember that iconic hit from the Pro Bowl where
I
don't remember who he laid out, but he went out there in this friendly All-Star game and just absolutely lit somebody up with the biggest hit I've ever seen. Who would go out and do that in a CFL All-Star game?
My first thought was Josh Bell, and I know he's now a coach, hasn't played in a number of years.
Coming off the sideline to do it.
He would have been that guy who I think would is like, no, my intensity is an 11 out of 10 at all times, and if you come across my part of the field, I'm going to make you feel it. I think Josh Bell would have been that guy. As for an active player, that's a really good question. Nobody's really popping up. Maybe our listeners can tell us on social media who they think it would be for active players.
I don't know if either of these guys are at this stage in the career going to make an All-Star game, but I think you could make an argument that Micah Allway or Deontay Williams in BC, those two guys, certainly when they see somebody a little bit vulnerable across the middle, would love to step into them and lay a declieger. So I might lean towards those two guys. Of course, I see them a little bit more regularly than I do some of the other big hitters in the league, but that was my first thought.
That's a good answer. I like Micah Allway. And by the way, in week two, when I asked Chris Kolonkowski, center for the Blue Bombers, about his lead block on Matthew Peterson's touchdown, he called his own pull. So he snaps the ball, pulls to become the lead blocker. And I forget the exact wording he used, but he said, referencing Micah Allway, who wears number three, he said, well, offensive line coach Marty Costello told all of us all week on the polls, three brings heat. It was something to that effect, or it was like three brings physicality. So in other words, if you pull and the guy there to block is number three, you have to be prepared for the hit to be more than one would typically expect from a 230-pound linebacker. Like, as a center, you typically expect to win that matchup. Mm. With Micah Allway, that is not a guarantee. He can hit with the best of them. So that's a good point. And I also, by the way, I don't know if you saw any of it, JC, because you're at the game in person, but Micah Allway, I thought, did a great job sitting in on the panel. We reported before the season that the CFL on TSN was going to have some active players. I thought Allway did a great job.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. I didn't see it, but Micah Allway, I mean, I know he's got a reputation with some fans for, you know, playing on the edge because of how hard he is as a hitter. one of the most intelligent guys in the entire CFL. He might be at the top of the list. I think he's, you know, a full-fledged engineer. He could be making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the private sector at this stage. Extremely well-spoken, but loves football so much that he just goes out there and de-cleats people and then sits down and very eloquently talks about it afterwards. But a highly intelligent guy, it does not surprise me at all that he was good in a panel segment.
Let's go to the three-minute drill. The CFLPA unveiled its new slate of team player reps. What stood out most to you about the changes?
Well, there's a lot of big stars on this list, but the thing that stood out to me is I think for the first time, we've got two player reps for teams that are global players. Maxime Royer, the French linebacker in BC, is the first rep for them. Tyron Vrede, the Dutch linebacker for the Ottawa Redblacks, is their alternate. But I know we've discussed in the past whether the global program is going to stick around long term. We've got a new commissioner who didn't bring it in. Could that potentially result in it being axed? Well, if global players are now established enough to get their fingers into union business in the CFLPA and are actually representing their teammates, I think that reduces the likelihood that even if the commissioner wanted to or the CFL wanted to, they could get rid of that program because now they're actively involved in the union where they weren't several years ago. And in fact, I think the CFLPA was a little bit skeptical of having them involved with the league. I think that is a shift to keep your eye on. The Riders sat Kadeem Carey for week 3, denying him a chance to play against his old team, the Toronto Argonauts. Was that the right choice?
I mean, I guess it was because AJ Ouellette played well and they won. But my goodness, I hated this decision with the passion of a thousand burning suns. I do not cheer for or against teams. I do cheer for good stories. And Kadeem Carey going to play his old team just 3 weeks after getting cut would have been a great story. And unfortunately, we were denied this. I think I tweeted last week, the first thing I thought when they announced that he wasn't going to play was that classic Matthew McConaughey line, "It'd be a lot cooler if you did," and I stand by that. It would have been a lot cooler, Saskatchewan, if you had played Kadeem Carey. Oh, well. Again, credit to them. They won anyway. The Edmonton Elks released starting defensive back Emmanuel Rugamba. Will that fix their problems in the secondary?
I don't know that it will fix their problems, but clearly he was struggling in the role that they had ascribed to him in Edmonton. And I know they're very high on some of the inexperienced guys that they brought in. They get a little bit of cap savings here, even though they spent $15,000 on his signing bonus in the offseason. When it comes to Rugamba, I'm just confused. Like, this guy was great as a strong side linebacker when he played that position in BC. BC moved him to halfback. He didn't look great there. Edmonton brought him in, presumably to play strong side linebacker. That was all the talk. And then they play him at halfback again and cut him after 2 weeks. It just seems like you're playing this guy out of the position that he is best suited to be in. Saskatchewan posted a profit of $2.1 million in 2024, Hodge, due in part to the successful rollout of their alternate uniforms. Should more teams try alternate looks?
Yes, I absolutely think so. I think the Owls' red jerseys look great. I really want to see the Ottawa Redblacks do a full Rough Riders throwback. I think fans in Ottawa have been clamoring for that for like 10 years at this point. Everybody loves BC's gunmetal jerseys, and the obsidian green in Saskatchewan is popular as well. So, yes, I think that more teams should do alternate looks, and I also think they should feel free to throw caution to the wind a little bit. Like Edmonton's, you know, traditional green look that they made last year, I think is okay, but it's not that different, right, from their normal look. I think take a big swing, maybe not as far as the Blue Bombers did 10 years ago when they randomly wore Toronto Argonauts jerseys that were like camo and double blue. That was terrible. But find something that is bold, that still represents you and your colors. Fans will buy it and you will get hype. I think that's all positive. After apologizing for his poor play in week 2, Brett Lawther missed a 33-yard field goal late in Friday's game that would have put the score out of reach at BMO Field. Is it time for Saskatchewan to make a change at kicker?
I don't think it is yet. We've seen struggles like this early in the season from Brett Lawler before, and he generally dials it in. He also has the type of leg where he can make from outside of 55 on occasion, which is highly valuable in the CFL. What I would say is if I was the Saskatchewan Roughriders, I would look at the Rolodex and see if there's another kicker I could bring in on the practice roster just to make sure I have one in-house and I'm evaluating week to week, because after two poor performances, I'm not worried. After three, after four, then I'm going to start to be. So they should get ahead of themselves here and make sure they have the right guy in the building just in case. The Riders unveiled a multicolored version of their indigenous logo this week. Did you like it, Hodge?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I know anything except green and white can almost be considered sacrilege in the province of Saskatchewan, but I thought this was one of few exceptions. I thought it looked great, and credit to the artist who did a great job with it. Really, really good job with it. For JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. We thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. Please join us on Wednesday for our picks for week four and enjoy the games. We'll see you then.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.